I am Plot on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. I grappled with how to introduce my guest now, so I went to his website and just got this off of there. Actor, author, director, comedian, musician, philosopher, political satirist, record company owner, and one of the best voices in the business, just ask The Simpsons. Harry Shearer is a comic personality and modern-day Renaissance man. He's more than that, of course. He was in This Is Spinal Tap and other movies, including A Mighty Wind, For Your Consideration, The Right Stuff, Real Life, The Fisher King, and The Truman Show. He was a cast member on Saturday Night Live and began his career as a child actor in such programs as General Electric Theater, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Leave It to Beaver, and the Jack Benny program. He joins me now to talk about a recent television series he starred in, Nixon's the One. It aired on British television last year and is now available on YouTube. Go to My Damn Channel on YouTube to watch all six episodes. Mr. Shearer plays Richard Nixon, and the dialogue is derived from Nixon's tapes. It's a fascinating program that reveals a little bit more about the 37th President of the United States, his persona, his idiosyncrasies, and his mania. I'll ask Mr. Shearer about why Nixon has fascinated him so and what he's learned about Nixon since doing it, despite decades of interest. HarryShearer.com is the website for more. You can listen to or download his very fine podcast, The Show, off there, which airs on public radio in the United States. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Plant Online program from Los Angeles today, Harry Shearer. Mr. Shearer, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. I do have to take that word philosopher off the website. I don't know how that got in there. I'm not.
No, you're
never,
not.
Never wanted to be.
No. But everything else stands, I guess.
Yes.
It's been a hell of a good career, hasn't it?
So far, so good.
Yeah. And in reading up about you, and we'll talk about Nixon in just a sec, but it's and I guess this builds into the Nixon program, is that at this point in your life, in your career, you're doing everything you want to do.
No, I'm not doing everything I want to do. I'm not doing anything I don't want to do.
Well, yeah, cause that makes sense then, yeah.
I mean, there are things I want to do that I haven't yet been able to accomplish because I haven't been able to raise the money or get the technology partners. I'm thinking of two particular projects. But I'm not doing anything that I don't want to do because I the rent is paid.
Yeah, and I guess that's the fun part now of one's life, one's career, right?
That is what you go through the struggling part to get to, hopefully, you know, if you're very, very, very lucky. There are plenty of extremely talented people who put in all that hard work and don't have that luck. And, you know, it ill behooves anybody in show business who's, quote, made it, unquote, to forget about the huge role that luck plays in all of this.
So I'm 32, but despite that, I've been fascinated by Nixon, as well as Johnson and other American presidents, of course. But Nixon, for me, has always been the most interesting because he was the honest.
Craziest.
Yeah, yeah. And
let's be honest.
Yeah, and you know, it culminated last year with me going to the Nixon Library for the day.
Ah.
And just walking around there and taking that all in. I actually ran into Brian Lamb that day, and that was great to stop and chat with him at the Nixon Library. So for me, this is a great pleasure to talk to you, because what I really want to know is what was it like to dress up as Nixon, to put that ski jump nose on, to do the voice, and to essentially play him as you have? I mean, it must have been fun, was it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had been, quote, doing, unquote, Nixon for a long time. I was in a comedy group called The Credibility Gap in Los Angeles back when Nixon was president. So willy-nilly, we were a satirical group when one had to do Nixon. The difference over time, I mean, and I've played him a couple of times since, but the difference is that when you're a satirist, and I still am and love doing it, but you're basically using your satirical intuition as to what a guy might say in a situation like this and sort of coming in from the outside, as it were. In this case, my writing partner and I, he was Stanley Cutler, the distinguished American historian who actually filed the lawsuit to make the tapes public in the first place. Otherwise, we would still never have heard one second of them. Focused on the non-political, non-Watergate, non-Vietnam conversations, of which there are plenty, to reveal the guy's character. And so now we have the real words. One's playing him from the inside in another sense, you know, in a different way. So even, and he's a guy who loved to talk. He would have people in the White House, people who worked for him, people who were trying to lobby him or influence him, all sorts of people. And they, based on the conversations that Stanley and I have heard, more often than not, they just sit there spellbound or bored silly, one of the two, while he delivered these professorial soliloquies, basically, that are ultimately revealing in every single imaginable way. So, you know, when you're writing satirical sketches, you wouldn't dare write a three-page speech for Nixon in the middle of it. But that's exactly what's going on here. Three-page, four-page, you know, just endless disquisitions on things he knows something about, or equally, things he knows nothing about, with equal professorial insistence. So it was a very different approach to him this time around. Much more enveloping, much more engrossing, much more, you know, while you're rehearsing this kind of material, as is any rehearsal, the cast is discussing the meanings of lines and things, and we're all discussing what really is going on here and stuff like that. So that kind of work just gets you deeper into a guy than you ever had dreamed of doing before.
So the Nixon that we hear on these tapes, that we see on Nixon's The One, do you think this is the real Nixon?
Well, you know, what I can say is this. It's the real Nixon that he exposes to co-workers, colleagues, people down the, well, he is at the top of the mountain, so everybody he's talking to is below him on the totem pole, and seekers of favors. It's not the Nixon that's at home with Pat or his daughters. That Nixon will remain unknown. Anything relating to personal matters by terms of the agreement that made the tapes public is being excised or redacted from the tapes before they're made public, which is one reason why it's taking so long for the tapes to become public, is because the guys at the National Archives have to listen to every tape and pick out the stuff that will not be made public. It's a Nixon we'd not known before, in the sense that, speaking as one of them, people who did Nixon impressions always did the public Nixon, the Nixon who spoke at press conferences or in speeches. This is a different Nixon from that, definitely, both vocally, in terms of how his voice actually sounds. It's a different Nixon than you hear on those public appearances. And it's a different Nixon, of course, in the way that he allows himself to talk. He's much more profane. He's much more dismissive of various kinds of groups of individuals than he would allow himself to be in public. So it's definitely a different non-public Nixon. It may not be the ultimate. I don't know if there is an ultimate interior Nixon. That's a question to ponder, I think.
Now, the sort of Nixon that we see in watching you inhabit this character, inhabit this man, he physically, I mean, that's just as much as doing the voice, I guess, in terms of... So how did you... Because there's a couple scenes in here where he's sitting on the sofa talking to whoever he's talking to, Kissinger, Billy Graham, and he seems very fidgety. He can't seem to sit still.
Yes.
How did you know that he was doing that at the time? I mean, could you hear that on the tape?
No. The physicality of it was where we had license. First of all, we placed the entire show in the Oval Office, just to make it claustrophobic. You're trapped in this room with this guy and you can't get out, even though some of these conversations may have happened in his other office. And we had to move him away from the desk from time to time. I don't know where he was sitting at the time of these conversations, but the director and I agreed you just couldn't do a half-hour show with him always just sitting in one place. So he gets up, he walks around, he goes to the sofa, he comes back, he stands at the window with his back to Kissinger for one scene. We had the license to do that. I knew, from having observed Nixon for a long time, that he was a guy who, in many aspects of his day, just seemed physically uncomfortable in his body. And so, there were scenes where I thought that was appropriate to play that. Certainly the scene where Oral Roberts, the American televangelist, comes to pay him a visit. And oddly enough, they're the only two people in the office. Mm-hmm. There's no aide to say, Mr. Roberts, your 10 minutes is up. So Oral Roberts just stays and basically talks Nixon's ear off, and that was an opportunity to, Nixon's not saying very much, to just play the physicality of, I'm very uncomfortable, this guy is getting close to me, and nobody's here to get me out of here, get him out of here. There's a scene where he's talking to Henry Kissinger, and it's 10:30 at night, and he's clearly had a couple of glasses of something alcoholic. And so there was the opportunity to, and the question, okay, what's the physicality of the slightly or more than slightly intoxicated Nixon? So there were all those things to explore that, you know, we were anchored literally word by word, pause by pause to the text, but the intuition and the freedom and the creativity came in the physical side of it.
Was there a license taken in how Kissinger or Haldeman, in how they're portrayed and how they react to something? Say, if Nixon says something incendiary, I look at Kissinger, I look at Haldeman, and there's almost this look of looking mortified at something Nixon said. I mean, certainly rolling their eyes at some points.
Well, you know, again, you can't tell that from the tape. That Kissinger makes some grunts from time to time that Henry picked up on. Haldeman's job, basically, in many ways, to use a metaphor from the space program, was to act as a heat shield for Nixon. Nixon said a million things, you know, go do this, go do that, go firebomb the Brookings Institution, famously, that Haldeman never did. The first episode in the series ends with Nixon telling Haldeman, destroy the tapes. And Haldeman never does that, crucially. Haldeman's job, in a sense, is to just listen to all this blather, absorb it, and then go out and try to keep some semblance of a rational government going.
Well, what do you make of especially Kissinger, because they both come off in the tapes and into this program, Nixon's the one, as I mean, sucking up to one's boss, I mean, is a given, I guess, if you're working in the White House. But I mean, in this case, it comes off just a great deal. I mean, it certainly heightened, and it doesn't reflect well, I guess, on certainly Kissinger.
Well, you know, that relationship is to me is the most interesting and the funniest of all of them, which is why we devoted an entire episode to that relationship. Kissinger was two things that Nixon despised: a Harvard professor and a Jew. And Kissinger knew of Nixon's attitude. As a matter of fact, there's a scene in the show where Nixon just sits there and berates Kissinger about Harvard professors and Yale professors, and now we're never going to have any of them in the White House ever again. Never, never, never. And he repeats the word never. And Kissinger just sits there and takes it. He used obsequiousness as his tool of dealing with this. You know, you said sucking up. I mean, one's reminded of the Ross Perot quote, the giant sucking sound. I mean, mm-hmm. Nobody in the history of sycophants has ever sucked up more thoroughly and more relentlessly as Kissinger. There are so many tapes of him coming into the White House and going into the Oval Office and saying, Mr. President, that speech you gave yesterday, that was the best speech. That was the best press conference you ever gave. No, the other press conferences were good, but this one was great. And Nixon knows that's what Henry's doing. He fishes, he forces him to do more. Little bit at the end, that was right, good, right? That worked, didn't it? He doesn't just sit there as a passive receiver of this. He keeps pushing, prodding Kissinger to do more, knowing that it must pain Kissinger somewhere down deep to be doing this. So he pushes him. Kissinger, of course, sticks around because Nixon offers him the great prize, access to power. I was at an event 2 years ago that was celebrating the 100th anniversary of Nixon's birth. A friend of mine is a Washington journalist, and she thought it would be funny or fun for me to attend this as her guest. And Kissinger delivered the keynote speech, and he basically said, you know, Nixon was a great president because he let me run things. So access to power was why Kissinger was there. Nixon, on the other hand, seemed to crave the presence of someone else around who he thought was as smart as he thought he was. And he was smart. He was a very intelligent guy. He was crazy like a loon, but he was very intelligent. And he craved someone he thought was at his level intellectually, and could thereby ratify some of Nixon's ideas, because if a smart person agreed with him, then it had to be right. So there was and yet there's this discomfort at the two of them, knowing that the underlying contempt that kind of underlays this. So it's like watching two spiders trapped in a bottle. It's to me, it's an amazing relationship.
Well, was the Oval Office that you worked in, was that to scale?
It was to scale, and it was absolutely as it had been decorated by Pat or whoever during Nixon's administration. Every president who comes in has the Oval Office redecorated, and the crew that worked, the British crew that worked on this show, was absolutely meticulous in researching and making this a spot on copy of the Nixon Oval Office. They went so far down the line. I mean, the last scene in the series is the 8 minutes before he delivers his resignation speech, and he's just bouncing off the walls in the Oval Office, and there are two cameras there to shoot the resignation speech, a primary camera and a backup camera. And I called a friend of mine at CBS in Washington. CBS had been the pool feed for that event, and I said, "Well, what model camera were those that they used?" And he found out, and my crew found the one guy in England who had two working models of that camera still. You could still see through the blue black and white image through the viewpiece, the eyepiece, the viewfinder. And they brought him down to London to with his cameras to operate them during the scene. So it was that was exciting. That my desire that we get it right. I mean, we had this great gift, the actual words spoken. Why not pay it the ultimate respect of getting everything around it right? And everybody on the cast and crew just bought into that theory of the case, and that made, you know, there was no arguments about, nobody will notice. It was just thrilling to be part of a project where everybody bought into that premise.
Are you as tall as Nixon?
No. And thank you for asking.
Yeah, no, just because I noticed that when you're walking around in the White House, that was something that I could tell right away.
Mm-hmm.
That I mean, even though you physically looked like him or you sounded like him, there was something just a little. I mean, and it's...
No, he was about 4 inches taller than me, I believe.
I see, yeah. Did you come away from portraying Nixon, sympathetic seems like the wrong word, but empathetic, say, towards him?
You know, it's an odd mixture. As I say, coming from a background where, you know, I was a willing non-participant in the Vietnam War, so I had a very personal interest in the Nixon administration. And he had been this bogeyman figure to California liberals. I grew up in Southern California, and he was always, you know, the personification of what was wrong with the Republican Party. His dirty campaigning, his furtive looks, all of it. One couldn't help thinking and realizing while we were shooting, you know, I'm thinking a lot about the guy. As much as I didn't like a lot of his foreign policy, his domestic policies, much of it, were way to the left of the current incumbent Democratic president. It tells you not so much about Nixon, but about the as we like to say in the United States, the journey we've been on.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon, by making a bold move to disconnect the southern states from their historical home in the Democratic Party and reroute them in the Republican Party, succeeded in creating a Republican Party that he could not have continued to be a member of. With his policies, he would have been, as we say, primaried out by a Tea Party candidate in 2010 or 2012 or 2014. So there is no home in the modern Republican Party for Richard Nixon. He was not a liberal Republican. He was smack in the middle. Goldwater was to his right. Nelson Rockefeller was to his left. He saw himself as right in the center of the party. As a person, you know, I realized that he had a molten core of burning resentment, some of which had to do with having been born in rural Southern California, and looking at all those, you know, smarty pants people in the northeast of the United States who had all the advantages and all the fancy education at the fancy schools and so forth, and made the connections that were going to set them up for life. Total burning resentment of all that. The apotheosis of that world, of course, was the Kennedys, and so when he gets defeated by Kennedy in 60, it's incredibly crushing. He talks in one scene in the show, it's 8 years later, mm-hmm. and he's talking to Kissinger about Kennedy wouldn't invite him to a social event while he was in the White House. And he's still burning up, and nobody bothers to say, Mr. President, Kennedy's dead, and you won. So he didn't have the let it go gene, you know. But I realized while we were making the show, you know, I have a little of that. I grew up in Southern California. We're not rural. I grew up in Los Angeles. But I made that same observation that, you know, you do get certain advantages by either growing up in that East Coast corridor or moving there as soon as humanly possible. And you make a choice, something happens. If you don't make that choice, or if you don't have that advantage, it's not this volcano that it was in Nixon. And I also came to share some of his negative feelings about the news establishment that's based in New York and Washington. I've had an experience in the recent past making a documentary about a major American news story and finding out what really happened and finding some frustration that the East Coast-based media didn't really care to do the follow-up work to report that part of the story. And it affects the city where I live, which is New Orleans, which made it fairly emotional for me.
Mm-hmm.
So when Nixon rails about the people at the New York Times or the Washington Post or at the networks, there's anti-Semitism in him underlying it. It's not in me, but I share some of little bit of that frustration. So I don't know whether you call it empathy or what, but I mean there were points where I came to a deeper understanding of him. Let's put it that way.
I've interviewed Conrad Black, who's a biographer of Nixon's and who knew Nixon. He told me that as the years go on, history will look more favorably on Richard Nixon. Then more of these tapes come out, and it just makes the picture all the more complex. So where is Nixon's place now in history, and do you think it'll improve at all?
I think he's pretty much settled where he's going to be. I mean, people writing about Nixon now, I think, would focus in terms of domestic policy on he created, or under his administration, the Environmental Protection Agency was created, a major accomplishment. Now the subject of attack from the very right wing of his own Republican Party. Created the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Several more things like that. Actually, gave a speech advocating for a guaranteed annual income for all Americans.
Huh.
Never happened, of course, but
yeah.
Things intervened. But, you know, gave that speech. And, of course, they'll write about the opening to China. Now, growing up with Nixon, so to speak, in my ken, I was aware that the opening up to China was preceded by 40 years of savagely attacking anybody who proposed opening up to China as a pinko and a red.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, a mixed record on that score. I think, to me, you know, doing the show, this is not a political show, it's not an educational show, I approached it as a comedy show, it's a character comedy. And to me, the character of Nixon is what I focus on. And, you know, I don't think historians write maybe psychological history if they choose to, and try to figure out why a leader's choices might have been based on his pathology or psychology. But to me, that's what is key to Nixon, is just how a guy with this volcano of resentment, as I describe it, manages, despite his lack of advantages, to climb up the greasiest pole in American life, get to the top, and not be able to forgive his enemies for losing to him. It's just so wonderfully goofy, you know. I don't think that's really where historians go. What else, you know, I mean, the story of the Vietnam War is a story that, you know, has the fingerprints of at least three presidents on it. None of them acquitted themselves with honor. I don't think that gets any better with age. I mean, what you've had since then are two more wars where American presidents made some of the same mistakes. So clearly it doesn't even serve as a teaching experience, a teachable moment, as we say in America.
Yeah. A lot of people have compared Mr. Burns on The Simpsons to Nixon. Was that something in mind when you created the voice?
No, not at all. No, Burns is a pretty two-dimensional character by comparison, and you know, that's what's funny about him, is he's just pure evil. But no, Nixon was the farthest thing from my mind at that moment.
And you touched on the few minutes before the resignation speech, which is fascinating. And I mean, I've watched that on C-SPAN over the years and just enjoyed watching you do it on Nixon's The One. These few minutes before he goes on air, where he's joking around with the crew.
Mm-hmm.
These are the few moments before he's resigning the presidency of the United States, and he's acting all goofy. And it's just a weird, surreal moment. Your theory on what his behavior was that night is interesting. I mean, I don't know if I totally agree with it, but you think that at that moment he was rehabilitating himself?
I think he was beginning the campaign. You know, I've watched that tape probably hundreds of times.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was really fun about this project was the minute he gets up from the desk and walks away from the camera and the microphone, what he says in the room goes into sort of obscurity for a good minute and a half. And I was, because it was necessary in working with these tapes generally, they're so badly recorded, to use a lot of sound processing to get all the words to come out of the murk. We did the same thing with this scene. And so for the first time, you hear really clearly what he's saying to the guys on the crew when he walks away from the desk. But as I say, I'd watched it hundreds of times, and I'd been like you. I thought, oh, it's goofy, it's surreal, it's improbable. This is a guy who had the least gift for small talk, probably of anybody in politics, forget about the presidency. And yet, at this moment of approaching ultimate mortification, what does he do? He engages in the most inane small talk. Goofy choice. And it was only when we were in the middle of doing the show and I came upon the tape of this scene ends with the end of the speech, because that was the end of the CBS feed. So one never knew what he was saying, or if anything, after he concluded the speech. But in the midst of rehearsal, I came across a little blog post by somebody who, a White House staffer who'd been in the room that night. And the piece of information that I gleaned from that was the only words that Nixon said after he finished his speech. This was August 8th, and his final words to the room were, "Have a Merry Christmas, fellas." Again, just absolutely goofy, but something struck me about that choice. He knew what date it was, clearly. Yeah. So he was planting a seed. What kind of seed was it? He was a guy who prided himself on never giving up and always getting into the next campaign. And I thought at that moment, he is beginning, this is not a goofy choice, this is a choice. He wants the guys on the crew to go home that night and tell their friends and family. He wasn't upset, he wasn't angry, he wasn't depressed. He was a nice guy. He was even joking. He was joking around. He even wished us a Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
And that they would remember that, 5 months later, at Christmas time. He was beginning the next campaign. I think that's true to his character. It's as good a guess as I can make, because it is true to this guy who always was looking for the next campaign and always was telling people, you never give up. That's when you lose.
Well, one of my favorite Nixon speeches, I guess, is the one the next morning, just before he gets on the helicopter.
My mother was a saint?
Yeah. Others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. I mean, did you ever think of doing that?
Well, but that, there's nothing new to add to that, you know? Yeah. I mean, the point is not to just, as Nixon would have said, wallow in all this wonderfulness. The point was to, it seemed to me, to bring new material to the public, because very few people are going to go to the trouble of, even though it's all available online, you have to search. There's no transcripts for most of these, so you just have to go fishing, which is what we did. And then the sound quality is so bad that it really, you have to be pretty dedicated to listen to this stuff. So there's nothing new to be brought to the table with that speech, because it's there for everybody to see and hear in pristine analog color.
Mm-hmm.
It is a wonderful, wonderful, mawkish, self-pitying, just Nixon at his... this is clearly after a night of possible alcohol imbibing, I would suspect. But, and the... That moment where he says, nobody's ever going to write a book about my mother,
mm-hmm.
but my mother was a saint. To me, just, you know, the first half of that sentence is all about those people who, you know, the East Coast liberal Jewish establishment media will never write a book about this woman. But, and then he, you know, apotheosizes her to the skies, you know, she was a saint.
When people talk to you, do they ask you about The Simpsons more or Spinal Tap?
Depends who they are. Mm. It's pretty much half and half. Some people are tap heads. Some people just can't get enough of The Simpsons. It's you know, one nice thing about doing a varied career is that you can't always predict what people are going to come up to you with, which is, I think, makes encounters with people in the public more surprising and interesting than it might otherwise be.
The guy my favorite comedian is Jack Benny, and I grew up listening to him and watching him on television. And I'll go on YouTube and watch a show. So here are some of those specials that he did near the end of his career. Mm. So you worked with him as a kid.
I worked for him for 8 years. Yes.
Yeah. So he was a nice guy, was he?
He was the best. You know, it's easy for one to have said that, you know, from a child's point of view, but I ran into a lot of people who were distinctly sub-best in my child's career as an actor, so I could tell the difference. No, he was... The whole ambiance of the show was of quiet professionalism. You know, I compare it to sitcoms that I've been around since then where people are tearing their hair out and basically operatic scenes are being acted out in the vain attempt to find a better joke. He had four writers who'd been with him forever. He had this cast that'd been with him forever. Everybody knew what they were supposed to do. It seemed so sane, you know. If you're going to make people laugh, you should be having fun yourself. There was a looseness, and yet a looseness never meant a lack of discipline, professionalism, and he was very, very, very nice to me, personally.
And you became good friends with Mel Blanc, is that right?
I became friendly with Mel Blanc.
Oh,
I didn't hang out at his house a lot, but, I mean, when we worked on the show together, he was always a really wonderful presence. He you know, especially after I lost my dad, he had a kid the same age as me, so, you know, there was a role he filled, you know, when we would work together that was very important.
See, you think of people like Mel Blanc, Rochester, obviously, Frank Nelson. These were three in particular who came from radio to television, and they made the transition effortlessly, and the emphasis was on their voices. So I'm wondering, because you were friendly with Mel Blanc and been around Benny, being a mimic, say, was that something that you did early on?
I did it in my bedroom, putting myself to sleep, you know, doing my versions of shows that I would watch. It wasn't something that I thought seriously about because, of course, I had a kid's voice, and, you know, what I realize now in retrospect that I was doing, because since, as I say, I had a kid's voice, I couldn't sound like anybody except me, but in my head, I was sounding like these other people. I was, in that way, the way play is always really work for kids, I was training my ear to be able to hear these different things, that when I got a voice, a grown-up's voice, I could then see if I could replicate them. But the stuff I was doing as a kid was really just ear training in an odd way.
And isn't that everything in life? I mean, even asking questions of people, it's listening, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, that's, you know, the cliche about really good acting is it's and especially improvisation, but all acting really is about listening. People, you know, the superficial version is it's about talking and moving, but it's basically about, so much of it is about listening, because your performance is linked to what you've heard from another person in the scene, so.
No, you've played other presidents, obviously, on your podcast, on your radio program, and, mm-hmm. and elsewhere. Is there any other president that you'd like to play physically?
Well, I played Reagan a couple of times on HBO shows that I've done, who was really fun. And I've done George W. in a couple of videos that I did for My Damn Channel. You know, there are all sorts of sensitivities that one faces in doing Obama physically,
uh-huh.
Which is why I'm trying to get a different kind of form of sketch comedy that doesn't involve those, violating those sensitivities. I can't really be. It uses technological means. I can't be more detailed about it.
Yeah.
I mean. You know, I don't think he's physically as interesting as Reagan or Nixon because, you know, what's psychologically interesting about him is almost that withholding of motion. You know, it's very reserved, very cool, and so it's almost, it's the stuff you don't do that really would define an Obama characterization, it seems to me. Physically.
This Bryan Cranston play, the LBJ thing, is that something that you'd possibly want to do, say?
Now, see, LBJ to me is a great character, and there are tapes. But he, you know, you were averring to this earlier, he is such a large man, and used his physicality in every way, including the most grotesque ways, to impose himself upon his underlings. I don't think really that's something I could do unless I, you know...
get shorter actors.
fill the cast with little people, I was just going to say, yeah. I mean, actually, do you know that, and I don't know if it's still this way, but I do know it was this way when it opened. The LBJ Library in Austin, Texas opened with an Oval Office that they were very proud to announce was a 7/8 size recreation of the real one.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't explain that choice. And I thought, now that's not easy. You've got to call, you know, somebody and say, can you make a telephone that's 7/8 the size of an actual, I mean, how detailed was it? Because you can't just go and get that stuff off the shelf. And the only thing I could conclude was that this was a way of giving you a sense of how the world looked through the eyes of this very large man.
Hmm. Well, I heard that it was a last-minute thing, and they didn't have enough space.
Well, okay, but still, that's an awful lot of effort and expenditure to go to.
That's right.
You've got to get now a 7/8 size desk. I mean, they're going on the. I mean, probably they had real size pencils, but you know, how detailed did it get?
Harry, this has been such a delight for me because, as I said, I'm a bit of a Nixon file, and I've really enjoyed these programs, and to get to talk to you about them and about him has just been such fun for me, so I appreciate your time today, and congratulations on this. It's a when you watch the show, it's a very fine achievement, and
well, thanks very much.
Thank you again.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
the website from our harryshearer.com, and you can watch these shows. Nixon's the one on YouTube, my damn channel. Look that up. The great Harry Shearer joined me on the line from Los Angeles and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.